arrival was almost unspeakable.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello and welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Vicky.
I'm Rachel.
That's right, Rachel's back.
Hey, it's me.
It went so well last time.
Yay,
we decided
she owes me
have what?
She owes me money.
Yeah.
I made her.
She's blackmailing me to be on the pod. No, it went so well last time we decided to have Rachel back.
Yay.
I have got to tell you, I didn't tell you when you got here because I had a story to tell you.
Ooh.
I had the most Midwest shit happen to me this morning.
What? Love it.
I was on my way over here to record.
Uh-huh.
And I was just south of like 90 on 23.
Oh, okay.
Like the
yep.
new exits over there, right?
Yes.
And as I'm coming around that curve, there's a big curve that leads up to a series of roundabouts out by us.
Hate it.
I'm coming up to that curve and I see shadows in the distance and I'm like, are those like people on horses? I thought it was people on horses.
Ew.
And I got a little closer and I was like, is that like a group of deer? No. There was a group of cows that had gotten on the side of the road and were just like meandering across the road and like hanging out. And I slowed down because this big cow, and it was a mixture of like large cows and not like calf calves, but like, you know, like
not fully grown.
Yes.
Teen cows.
Teen cows. Yeah. Just kind of hanging out on the road, in the road, across the road, all over the road. So I kind of like waited for this cow. He had walked across to the other side and then walked back. So I went around him and I pulled off and I had to call 911 and say, I'm at this location and there's a group of cows in the road this morning.
That's amazing.
They were like, hold on, we have to transfer you to sheriff's because it's sheriff's department territory. And then I had to explain again that there was a group of cows in the middle of the road.
To a very
I was
tired
truthfully worried because I'm pretty sure it was my, I can't remember. Okay. So truthfully, I have to ask my mom this. I can't remember if it was my mom in the car with my grandma or my grandma in the car with her mom.
Okay.
But my grandma was in a car when it hit a cow. Like they hit a cow when she was younger.
Oh.
And so
that's
it made me think of that.
Yeah.
Because that's like kind of a road hazard.
Yeah, that's definitely a road hazard. I was going to say, you'll see me nodding over here because I also recently had to call the police because there were cows on the road.
What the fuck is happening out here?
Yes. So I was on, oh my God, I don't know roads. I was coming back from Woodstock around where like deer passes.
Yeah.
And so like out in the country, kind of.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's a really fast road. People go like 90 down that road. And we're passing my husband's uncle's house. And in the ditch, there's these two. Now you saw teenage cows. I saw like full grown man, like giant, like steer ass cows. I don't know the term.
Oh, there was one of those. That was the one that was walking across the road back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
The closest to you is like the biggest, scariest one.
Yeah.
My mom and I were coming back from, I don't know, whatever. But yeah, we had to call the police. And when we got transferred to whoever, they were like, oh, by that location? Oh, yeah, we've already gotten calls from there before. And I was like,
oh,
today?
God.
And they're like, no.
Oh, just like in general?
Yeah. And
like
then
a,
we told.
A repeat offender?
Right. We told my husband's uncle this because we were like, there were cows by your house. That's so funny. And they were like, oh, yeah, it's this farm down the road. They like they get out all the time. And I'm like, that's I just feel like, again, yeah,
do
that's
they
such
get
a
fined for
hazard.
Letting them out of their fence if they
you
don't fix the fences
so.
Or something? I don't know.
I mean, no one would want to hit a cow.
And
but
I
they're
can't,
huge.
When I was talking earlier about it with Tiff and AJ, I have definitely seen like group. It is not uncommon to see groups of animals on the side of the road out here.
Yeah, for sure.
I've seen plenty of chickens like in ditches.
Oh yeah, yeah. And you're like, whose
and
chickens are these?
Where
I always call them free range chickens, but I don't think that's right.
No. But also like if you hit a chicken, not to be gruesome, like the chicken's not gonna win. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you hit a cow, the cow will probably fucking win.
Yeah, it'll probably be fine.
Total your car.
Yeah.
And I don't want somebody to get hurt like
true.
Hitting a cow.
That's true.
So that was my morning.
That was a really moving story.
Boo. All right. Well, on that note, we are going to head over to the newsroom. Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had
15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Our news this week comes to us from Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh.
Where at the Annapolis City Hall, some janitors showed up to work.
Uh-huh.
And discovered, this is on February 22nd, discovered a woman named Maureen Donovan who was sleeping by a second floor conference room.
Okay.
And this is from the Capital Gazette. According to charging documents, Donovan told police that after following a staff member through a scan access door, she had eaten some Hot Pockets.
Love it.
From the employee break room and spent the night.
Aw.
And so when they found her the next day, she had a gavel, the mayor's gavel, with her.
She stole it?
Well, she's sleeping with it, it sounds like. Sleeping with the gavel.
Like huddled
That's what I imagine.
That's really cute.
She did get charged with felony burglary.
Okay.
And two misdemeanors and theft of less than $100. The latter, a reference to the Hot Pockets, which police valued at $4.49.
Wow. That's cheap for Hot Pockets. They lowballed them on those Hot Pockets.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Unless there's just one box with two Hot Pockets.
You can't just eat two.
I mean, if that's all there is. There's only one box.
That's so sad.
So she is currently being held without bail after a couple of hearings and things.
Free Maureen.
And
I'm going to make t-shirts. Free her.
Yeah.
My girl did nothing wrong.
Interestingly enough, there has been quite a bit of public outcry saying that the punishments and stuff so far, like what she's facing, are pretty excessive for what happened.
It's kind of just like squatting, really. She just probably needed somewhere. I'm assuming she's unhoused. She probably just needed somewhere to sleep.
Yeah. And they've basically said, like, we've offered her the services that she needs to find housing or find food or whatever. But policy is like, if you offer those services and they deny,
then you go ahead with charges.
Yeah, you can be arrested at that point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, they didn't necessarily say she was in a mental health crisis at the time or not. They have not, like, confirmed or denied. But they...
Sounds normal to me.
Yeah, right.
Eat a Hot Pocket.
Eat a Hot Pocket in a government building.
Steal a gavel.
Yeah. So they are... She's currently being held in relation to these charges.
Maureen, a lot of it listening, I support you. I'm behind you 100%.
Oh my God.
I'm going to mail her Hot Pockets.
Okay. Is that rude? I don't know if that's rude or not.
Is it? Oh, I meant it in a nice way.
I know you did, but there's part of me that's like, would she be offended by that?
Oh, maybe she would. Cut that out.
No, leave that in.
No.
All right, we're going to move on to Netflix and Kill, where this week we are looking at a Max and Kill documentary called They Called Him Mostly Harmless.
Mm.
This was, first of all, it's like a documentary, documentary, so it's an hour and a half long, like, movie length. It was really interesting because it's kind of about a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off with the body of this hiker being found in a tent off of the Appalachian Trail.
Appalachian.
Sorry. I don't care. I'm kidding. The Appalachian Trail in a tent in Florida. Mm-hmm. Okay. And nobody really, he didn't have any identification on him. Mm-hmm. When they found him, his body was sort of emaciated.
Right.
Like, he didn't
had
look
he
like
been there for a little while.
He had been there for a little while, but like not like long enough to be decayed or anything.
Okay.
So the whole documentary is sort of the quest to figure out who this person is.
Right.
There's a lot of elements about the hiking community, which if you don't know anything about the hiking community, it's very like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like kind of a close knit.
Yeah.
People take care of other people on the trails.
It's like a family.
Yeah.
It really is. They're really all connected to each other.
One of the things is that you will normally get a trail name.
Mm-hmm.
And so people that had met this person on the trail knew him as Denim.
I thought that was really cute.
Yeah. Yeah. So these people are meeting him along the trail, but not really getting his identity.
Right.
They're sort of like, don't really know. I mean, which is not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
They also talked about how he didn't really have, he had sort of a bigger pack, like more stuff with him.
Mm.
And he talked about not carrying like a cell phone or like anything like that. He just hiked and did whatever. Some people on the internet get wind of this missing person.
Internet sleuths.
Exactly.
Love it.
And there are a lot of these communities that do like searches for missing persons and stuff. It's not uncommon. Web sleuths obviously is a big community.
I love that.
And then there's this interesting thing that happens where it's like some people from the hiking community and some people from just like the true crime community at large sort of get together and make this group on Facebook where they're trying to find his identity and put together these clues. And then, as there always is in these Facebook communities, there's like some rift that happens between like moderators and some other people. And then there's splinter groups. And then you have these two opposing groups like trying to the drama of the Facebook.
It's real.
Group is like its own story.
It's Shakespearean.
It's wild.
Yeah.
It's wild. So anyway, so there's all of that happening. There's some like false accusations happening online where people like get a hold of something and then they're accusing this wrong person. And he came on and did an interview.
Oh, no.
It was like people were contacting me to be like, are you this person? Are you this person?
Oh,
you keep telling us you're not this person, but we think you're this person.
That
blah, blah, blah,
sucks.
Blah. Yeah. So there's an aspect of that. Eventually, they hook up with this DNA company and crowdfund to get the DNA tested.
That was my favorite part. I love that they raised the money. And it only took like a week, I think it said.
Yeah. And
it was really short time.
This specific DNA company does, I forget what the actual name of it is, but it's like location-based DNA. So you can look at factors in somebody's DNA and sort of narrow down to an area where they would be located or where they would have grown up,
like
based
environmental.
On there's a name for it. And
I'm sure we've all seen it on like a million true crime shows where it's like, she had coal dust in her lungs. She must have lived downwind of the coal factory.
Right. It's relatively new.
Yeah.
But it is really cool, but it's expensive. So they did this crowdfund. They figure out he's from Southern Louisiana. And then they were able to find some people who knew him in Baton Rouge. And so they got DNA somehow from that and were able to cross test and discover that it is a gentleman named Vance John Rodriguez. And
that's so cool that they
figure out who he is. Okay. So if you don't want, this is going to be a big spoiler. So if you don't want this,
alert.
Turns out dude was kind of a piece of shit. He was abusive to like women and his girlfriends. He did have some mental health struggles too. Like that was part of like, he would stop eating and like kind of stop taking care of himself, like heavy depression and like some of these other things. He, I think there was also sort of this idea of perpetuation. So like he, I think, was abused when he was younger. So like,
right. The cycle of abuse.
Right.
Yeah. He came from pretty unfortunate circumstances.
Yeah. So then it's sort of the idea of like, you know, you want to help these missing people get their identities back, but then when you figure out who they actually are,
it's not always so open and shut.
And they
like,
talk,
you expect everyone's going to be happy, but it's like,
And they talk, the people who are interviewed talk a lot about, you know, like, I choose to remember him as Denim, the guy who was hiking the trail and like who we knew as this friendly guy. Who, you know, before we actually figured out who he was, which I think everybody was in agreement like that was a good thing. But
that's really cool. That's such a complex issue. I really haven't considered that before.
It was a really interesting documentary. I would definitely recommend it. Because it does look at a lot of things. There's this question of like, who really is this person? Do you really want to know, like, this could be a terrible person that you're figuring out, but is that worth still trying to figure it out? And what do you do with that information when you find out? There's this idea of online communities and like how quickly things can spiral, but also like how beneficial it can be when things work out as intended. You know, like,
that's interesting that like with each subject in this, there's like a big high and a big low.
Yeah.
Like a big positive, big negative. Like, we found this guy, we did it, we're heroes. but he kind of sucks. And that brought up a lot of bad memories. And, yeah.
And the whole internet sleuth thing also brought up a lot of issues for police, because now they're getting like hundreds of thousands of tips
right.
that they have to look at every single one.
Right. And they have to do in a certain way for it to mm-hmm. be able to be admissible. Yeah, mm-hmm. completely.
And a lot of them are just nonsense. Like, you right. know,
and that poor guy, hopefully the guy who got accused, who was like, I am not, in fact, a corpse in the woods.
Right.
That was not me.
Right.
Like,
right.
That sucks for him.
Yeah. 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 It's. Jeez. It's pretty, I don't know. I just That's really complex. Enjoyed it. It is complex for sure.
I love
sure.
that.
And the way that they filmed it and the people who ran there's the one woman who ran the Facebook group who is exactly what you imagine
oh, no.
when you think of like a middle-aged woman running a Facebook group.
Completely who just like
wants
stable.
Power.
What's yeah, power?
She's literally was like, yeah, so we had this fight with this other Facebook group, and then I stepped away from the investigation for a while, but then I decided to come back and start my own Facebook group. Uh-huh. And when I started it, literally is like, this was everything I ever wanted. I had all the power.
Oh,
I didn't have
God,
to. I was like,
girl.
excuse me.
If you're going to open a Facebook group, you should go to therapy. First and then
oh my
open.
God it was just like yeah it was kind of wild.
Not the Machiavellian God complex of the Facebook group.
Yeah. Please. I was like, you just said the thing.
Yeah,
okay, whatever.
You
anyway
said that thing.
It's called they called him Mostly Armless. Mm-hmm. It's on Max. Definitely check it out. This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners.
Mm-hmm.
This week we will have discussions of murder.
Yep.
Sure. I have some light discussion of suicide.
Mm-hmm. I've got a little bit of that too.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be talking a little bit about drug abuse, a little bit of mental health struggle.
Yeah. So if any of that is sensitive, if you're especially sensitive to any of that today,
that's okay.
Maybe skip this one.
We love you anyway.
But part of me felt like coming off of February, maybe. Mm-hmm. I was Ooh. Like, yeah, right. Like feeling the love, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You see where I'm going with
yes,
this?
I love it.
So I decided, because we missed Valentine's Day,
mm-hmm.
the big mark that is Valentine's Day, bloody Valentine, right?
Sorry.
No, it's
I
not.
I had COVID.
We would have had to record like 2 months ago to hit Valentine's Day.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You're good. It's don't worry, girl. It's not your fault. It's poor planning on my part.
No way.
So today,
this
afternoon,
morning.
Whenever you're listening to this,
whatever,
we are going to be talking about crimes of passion.
Ooh.
So my story, I decided to look, I couldn't even tell you how I found this. I don't even remember how I found this, but it's a story. I have to warn you. It's a story from India.
Okay.
So there's a lot of names and pronunciations
gotcha.
That I will try my best, but I'm not,
like
you know,
we said before, we're from the Midwest.
Yeah. Longtime listeners know that sometimes pronunciation is not my strong suit. You've already corrected me once this episode.
No, I didn't, because Tiff's going to edit it out.
No, it's fine. She keeps in all my flubs. She just edits out the one for the guests. So this week, I'm talking about a gentleman named Kamas Manekshaw Nanavati.
Okay.
Okay. So Kamas Manekshaw Nanavati was a commander in the Indian Navy,
mm-hmm.
and he was living in Bombay with his English-born wife, Sylvia.
Okay.
They had, this would have been in like the 1950s.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The couple had three children, mm-hmm. two sons and a daughter. And like I said, he was a commander in the Indian Navy. So mm-hmm. due to his position, Nanavati had to be away
right.
from home for long periods of time.
Okay.
Which sort of left Sylvia alone mm-hmm. at home, taking care of the house,
uh-huh.
taking care of the kids
mm-hmm.
For really long periods of time, like
okay.
months at a time.
I was going to say, I do it from 8 to 5 every day, and it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
If my husband left all the time, I'd be pissed.
I was just going to be gone for like 2 months. Like,
no.
Have fun.
I'm moving in
kids.
With my friend Vicky.
Great.
Vicky's
no.
your new dad.
Absolutely not. Best father figure ever.
Yes.
So
that's tough.
That is really tough.
Yeah.
And during this time, she became very close with a close family friend named Prem Bhagwandas Ahuja.
Okay. Is this a man person or a lady person?
A man person.
Was he hot?
I mean, kinda. These are like
hot neighbor hot.
Dude, I don't know. Do you want to see a picture?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I need to see if I'm on her side or not.
Let's see if I can just, I can't even just Google the last name. Sorry. Hold on. This had to be Prem.
Sorry, I didn't mean to throw you off.
Ahuja.
I think Indian names are so beautiful. I do have a lot of trouble pronouncing them, but they're so pretty.
Ahuja. Nanavati case. Here we go.
Nanavati. That's cool.
Let's see. Well, that's sorry. Okay. So this is Nanavati and Sylvia.
Okay, he's kind of hot. He's a little hot.
I'm going to see
Kathy Bates.
She does kind of look like Kathy Bates.
Ooh.
I want to see if I can
find. I love Kathy Bates.
Okay, so I believe this guy in the middle on the bottom is.
Yeah.
Prem.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, he's kind of hot. Audience, he's kind of hot. Not like a lot, but like kind of.
It's worth pointing out that these are like black and white pictures.
Yeah, but I don't know. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Vintage.
I know you're into that.
I am.
Anyway, okay, so Ahuja and Sylvia, they mm-hmm. fall in love.
Okay.
While Nanavati is absent and they start having an affair. Now, on April 27th, 1959, Nanavati had just returned home from 2 months away.
Oh, wow.
At sea. And he and Sylvia were sort of just going about their day. Mm-hmm. They were like running errands, right. Taking the dog for a walk. Everything was normal. But by this point, Nanavati had sort of noticed that his wife had become distant mm-hmm. and cold. Now, according to later testimony, Sylvia would say, quote, "My husband came and touched me. I asked him not to do it as I did not like him."
As I did not like him.
Yes.
Straightforward, girl.
Yeah. And so after this, Nanavati decided to question his wife as to whether or not she had been faithful while he was away. And it was at this point that Sylvia finally confessed that she had been having an affair with Ahuja. And although he was upset by this news, mm-hmm. obviously.
Right.
You
would think.
Nanavati was like, "I want to go over to talk to Ahuja myself."
Bad plan.
He was like, they describe him a lot as being very like calm and collected in the moment.
The husband?
It was like, yes. But was
that's
like.
That's bad though.
But was like, you know, I'm going to go talk to him myself.
Oh,
you know,
no.
Like very like, yeah. So.
That's a bad sign.
He takes Sylvia and the kids and drops them off at the movies and is like, "I'm going to come and pick you guys up later," and goes to the ship that he had been serving on.
Okay.
Where he retrieved a revolver with 6 rounds under false pretenses.
Now, friend, you don't need that for a nice neighborly chat.
Right.
Put those back.
And part of this, like, part of the Navy ship deal is, like, you have to sign this out. So
I was
like,
going to say, the fact that he stole ammunition, like, from the Navy.
Yeah.
That,
he signed it out, but he, like, told them.
Right. I need it for Navy stuff.
For Navy stuff.
Yeah.
For Navy stuff.
Yeah. They're like, of course.
Oh, sir. Yeah. Yeah, very, very good, Commander.
Like, Navy no problem, stuff, dog.
Yes, sure. So he goes to the ship. He picks up this gun. He then goes to Ahuja's office and finds out that he is not there. He's actually at home. So he goes to Ahuja's residence.
Man, he had so many times to not do this. I'm sorry.
Keep that in mind for later.
Oh,
keep that in mind for later. Okay.
Meditation, baby.
And so he goes to the flat. He goes to Ahuja's flat. Nanavati was greeted by Ahuja's servant because this dude is like super. You have to understand that. Well, okay. So here's the thing: is both of these guys are wealthy or considered like high class.
Uh huh.
Nanavati was literally a commander,
right.
In the Navy. So that's like kind of upper class.
Right.
And this guy, Ahuja, I think was a business owner, but was also like
very well off.
Rich enough to have a fucking servant.
Right. Right.
So that's richer than me.
Yeah.
I don't have a servant.
I wish. Oh my God.
Wouldn't it be nice?
It would be so nice. I would just want someone to fold all my laundry and put it away.
Oh my gosh. I know. That's I have some friends who have like a housekeeper that come by like once every other week even. It's not even like often. And I'm like, oh, that sounds like.
We need one. Hey, if you're out there and you're a housekeeper who just does it for pleasure and not money.
If you want to come clean my house for fun.
Hit us up. You can be on the podcast.
Listen, I didn't say that. You stop it. So Nanavati goes over to this house.
Right.
The servant's like, yep, Ahuja's home. Straight is like, yep, he's home.
Maybe he hated him.
Maybe. Who knows?
Like the commander coming to the door with the revolver out. He's like, he's upstairs.
Yeah, right.
He yelled at me earlier.
Also, I feel like as a servant, you're probably like, this is not my business. Yeah. Right, like, right. I just work here.
I don't get paid enough to care that you have a gun.
So he goes up to Ahuja's bedroom where he finds him and Nanavati closes the door and then begins demanding answers about this affair with his wife and whether or not Ahuja intended to marry Sylvia and take care of the children.
Oh.
Because he was, it seems like, kind of concerned, like, well, if you're going to be having an affair with my wife, like, you need to take over the responsibilities of caring for my wife and kids.
Okay, I'm kind of back on board with him.
And so Ahuja, to this, replied, I'm not bound to marry every woman I sleep with.
Oh my God.
Which completely sets Nanavati off. He flies into a rage and attacks Ahuja. And while this fight is happening, at some point, the gun gets pulled out or grabbed. Uh-huh. And Nanavati shoots and kills Ahuja. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought this was like a wholesome neighborly affair story. But this guy sucks. Baby, rest in peace.
And I find it really interesting that he's like, the fact that he was like, I don't have to marry everyone I sleep with.
Yeah.
Like, why would I marry your wife and then take, you know.
Right.
I'm not going to do that. And he's like, fuck you. And just kills him.
That's kind of it's kind of like he's still thinking about like her honor and stuff, even though she betrayed him.
Right. Interesting.
I kind of like him.
So immediately after this altercation and murder, Nanavati goes to, I forget what it's called, but it's basically like the head person on the naval ship.
Oh, okay.
And says, I just killed this man. Just killed Ahuja. And the head naval ship guy says, you need to go to the police. So he immediately goes to the nearest police station, confesses immediately to killing Ahuja, and was taken into custody. Right.
Okay.
So because, like we had talked about earlier, like he's considered upper class.
Right.
And this was kind of considered an upper class crime of passion.
Oh.
Remember, this is like late 50s, Bridgerton. Early 60s.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is still very much the era of like tabloid sensationalism.
Oh, I bet.
And
this was
news headlines that are a little
salacious.
Yeah.
Exaggerated.
Yeah. So this was viewed as an upper class crime of passion. Mm-hmm. The entire nation was completely engrossed in this case.
Yeah.
Nanavati was seen as this upstanding citizen who sort of found himself in an unfortunate situation.
Well.
There was also the fact that he did not have any sort of criminal history. Like he's a member of the military. He's never like had any history of this.
Right.
And he confessed to the police right away. This really made the public sympathetic of him. Like the public at large was like,
and that's understandable,
pretty on board with him.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting because you totally, it's been really fun watching your reaction because you've totally done exactly what everyone else did in this.
I'm
in
basic.
This case. So during trial, there was quite a bit of evidence that was presented, including three letters from Sylvia to Ahuja. And multiple depositions from Nanavati, as well as a couple other witnesses. But there was no actual, like, witnesses to the fight, to the actual fight and the shooting.
Right, right. Because the servant was downstairs and they were in the bedroom with the door closed.
Yeah.
Very scandalous.
So you know I'm very into, like, the legal side
you
of things.
You are.
Here. So excited about that because this case is crazy. A lot of the trial centered around whether this was premeditated murder or a crime of passion, like heat of the moment situation.
Right.
Okay.
Well, it was premeditated.
Was it?
Yeah.
You did say, you did you told say me. So in the beginning. So this is where Indian law becomes, at least Indian law at this
That's
time.
That's what I was going to say, is I don't know if they have different standards or
not. It gets kind of interesting because they provide some exceptions to the, essentially what the murder statute is over there. There's some exceptions that if the jury were to sort of get on board with that, it would reduce the maximum sentence from death or life in prison to a maximum of 10 years. Okay. There are really, and in this case, there are really two exceptions of Section 300 of the Indian Penal Code that would have applied to Nanavati. So these are the two exceptions. Exception one, culpable homicide is not murder if the offender, whilst deprived of power of self-control by grave and sudden provocation, causes the death of the person who gave the provocation or causes the death of any person by mistake or accident.
Victim blaming.
It's a little weird where it's like, if you... statute.
If he's just like real mad, then it's fine.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Like... And yeah, it sucks because, like, I can kind of, like, I'm, like, a little bit on board with that. Like, just a little. Just a little. I do think that emotional state should matter.
I agree.
Not down to, like, oh, you only get 10 years for killing somebody.
So this is the second exception.
Yeah.
Exception two. Culpable homicide is not murder if it is committed without premeditation in a sudden fight in the heat of passion upon a sudden quarrel and without the offender having taken undue advantage or acted in a cruel and or unusual manner.
Oh, no.
And in this case, there was also a little like addendum thing that says it is immaterial in such cases which party offers the provocation or commits the first assault, which I found really interesting.
What?
Yes.
That's insane.
Yeah. That so basically, it doesn't matter like who does the provoking.
Oh, my God.
It That's can still dumb. Be considered like a crime of passion.
Yeah. No, I disagree. India, I disagree.
So essentially.
Oh my God. That's weird.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes. That's something that I never really think about is like how different countries can have different standards when it comes to that.
Yeah. And a lot, I will tell you, like there's most places are different from the U.S.
Yeah.
The U.S.
Yeah,
is kind of its own monster in a lot of ways.
Well,
and I do find like other justice systems kind of interesting, just the way that they run. Because even Canada is like wicked different.
They're super different.
The
that's
United
true.
States and how they run their trials and like So that's what kind of why I wanted to go over this because I think we have some of these exceptions, but not to this extreme.
No,
Because there is like I think. The alternative for us is like the self-defense laws, which are kind of sketchy.
Right.
But it's very clear in those laws where it's like if the response is excessive or like is not equivalent to what is being brought on you.
Yeah.
And this is the difference of firing one shot when you're being attacked versus firing six shots.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. Like.
And I do think a little bit of understanding in that area is good. But like, I'm trying to think of like, there are cases, American cases that I've heard where it's like, okay, you killed that person kind of in the heat of the moment. It was kind of understandable. So instead of seeking like this really extreme penalty, like the death penalty, we'll give you 30 to life. Mm-hmm. Like it's really more about sentencing. But the fact that in like the second one that you said, like, it was like, it is not murder. It's not even murder if you're mad. That's crazy. No. That's such a distinction. Yeah.
So basically, if Nanavati was found guilty of culpable homicide rather than murder under
Real
one of
quick
these exceptions.
Sidebar, what does culpable mean?
Culpable means...
Responsible?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Culpable.
I'm stupid.
It's been a minute since I had to do...
I'm sorry.
No. When I was a paralegal, I had to do grammar for lawyers.
Oh, yeah, you had to know all the, like, definitions and stuff.
Yeah, and culpable was something that came up a ton.
For some reason, with...
Deserving blame.
Okay, so they did. Okay,
it's basically like saying you did the homicide, but it wasn't murder.
Got it.
Or saying, yes, I killed this person, but it wasn't murder.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. So, like, responsible.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yes.
Sorry.
No, it's all good. So, if he was found guilty of culpable homicide rather than murder, mm-hmm. under one of these exceptions, he would get a maximum of 10 years rather than potentially rather than potentially getting the maximum of life in prison or a death sentence.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah. So that is the exact strategy that his defense team decided to take.
Oh, man.
And Nanavati pled not guilty to murder, saying it was actually culpable homicide, not amounting to murder.
He's like, guys, you don't get it. I was so mad.
Yeah.
So mad.
Now, because Nanavati had been charged with full-blown murder and pled not guilty to that, the jury's job, literally the jury's job, was to find out if he was guilty or not guilty of murder. It was not to decide if he was, if it was actually culpable homicide.
Which is,
does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Like, you'd think, like, I feel like in American court, it's kind of like, okay, here I am at the police station. Here is the gun. Mm-hmm. This is where you have all the evidence already, pretty much. It would just pretty much, you would still have to have a trial, but it would pretty much be a sentencing trial.
Yeah.
Like, not exactly, but it would be more,
and
it, like,
it definitely depends on if they, like, pled guilty or not guilty, right?
Right.
But, like, there's a lot of instances where the jury's been a little conflicted because during the trial, like, the attorneys are asking them to decide this other thing, but, like, you have to, when you're on a jury, like, you have to sort of narrow your vision on, like, what is the actual things that they're being charged with.
Right.
That's all you can decide. You can't like decide all these extra
fits that letter of the law.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen a lot of, even in American trials, a lot of trouble with, like, determining premeditation.
Yes.
Which I determined just now.
Yeah.
He did that.
Which you
shit.
Did pretty much right away. Right. So they came back when all was said and done. The jury came back with an 8-1 verdict of not guilty.
What?
Of murder.
What?
Not guilty of murder. The Sessions judge, who had been presiding, found this a gross miscarriage of justice, saying, quote, no reasonable body of men could bring that verdict on the evidence, and then sent the case to the higher court for further deliberation, which is apparently something they could do in Indian court. He was like, I don't agree with the jury's verdict.
I'm sending it to another one.
Yeah, yeah. I think you might be able to do that in the U.S., but it doesn't. It's like a very rare occasion. Like, there has to be, like, a really obvious, like, jury misconduct thing going on. You know what I mean?
Would that be like sending it to the Supreme Court?
It would be. So it basically would be like the appeals court in the state, and then the Supreme Court of the state, and then the Supreme Court of the United States.
Got it.
Yeah. So
interesting.
I also saw that decision again, like, being sending it back up to the higher courts,
yeah,
or sending it up to the higher courts, described as this historic decision. So,
okay,
like,
so that wasn't,
it does not
usual.
Happen very
okay.
often. Yeah. So the matter gets sent to the Bombay High Court for retrial. Here, the prosecution argued that the previous trial judge had misled the jury on 4 points.
Oh.
One, the onus of proving that it was an accident and not premeditated murder was on Nanavati and his team.
Okay.
The second was whether or not Sylvia's confession of the affair was grave provocation, or if it was a specific incident in the affair.
Okay.
Three, wrongly telling the jury that provocation can come from a third party.
Hello?
So, like, he walked in and the servant said some shit. You know what I mean? And then
here.
He went upstairs and it was like, actually, I'm mad at the servant.
Like, hey, where's the neighbor? He's probably up there fucking your wife.
And then four, that the jury had not been instructed that Nanavati's defense had to be proved to the extent that there is no reasonable doubt in the mind of a reasonable person. So reasonable doubt.
So but what you just explained to me, pretty much.
Yeah.
And that's insane.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay,
so it sounds like the high court kind of has their shit together, maybe?
Yeah. So the Bombay High Court was totally on board with all of these arguments that the prosecution was making.
Okay.
They dismissed the jury's verdict, and they allowed the case to be heard fresh, saying that the jury had been influenced by the media a lot. Because there was also this, like, campaign in the media to sort of paint him positively.
The court of public opinion.
Yeah, very much so. Like, that is, like, a whole background thing happening that I just decided not to talk about.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So during this high court retrial, the defense sort of provided their own version of what happened on the evening that Nanavati went over to Ahuja's. So according to them, Nanavati was so distraught after Sylvia confessed to the affair that he initially intended to shoot himself, but was eventually calmed down by Sylvia.
Okay.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Because she had been sort of like unclear on whether or not she intended to marry Mary Ahuja, Nanavati wanted to find out for himself and decided to go over to his flat. The two still had, the defense still contended that both men had this discussion about like whether or not Ahuja intended to marry Sylvia and him being like, I don't have to marry everybody that I sleep with.
What a dog.
But when they started having this like scuffle.
That's kind of when they had different stories.
Yeah. So they were saying that when the gun got pulled out during the scuffle, it actually accidentally went off.
Whatever.
When Ahuja mistakenly pulled the trigger as he was like trying to like wrestle the gun out, which is like the same defense. I just want to point out the same defense that Robert Durst used in his trial for when he murdered the man down in Texas in Galveston. Yeah. So
they use that all the time.
I'm just saying.
I don't know.
Just saying.
I think that's silly.
Yeah. So to counter this, the prosecution pointed. So here's the thing is like the defense sort of had the story. The prosecution had like evidence.
Uh-huh.
Actual evidence.
Good like thing to have if physical you're going evidence. To trial. Oh, wow. Great.
So the prosecution pointed to this evidence that they had that Ahuja's towel had remained on. So he had actually been, he had like emerged from the shower.
Wow.
When Nanavati had gone up to the bedroom, he had just gotten out of the shower. So he had a towel on.
That's probably why they probably didn't even talk. He probably saw him and was like, he's hot, and then killed him.
Yeah.
That's my theory. Yeah. His like glistening muscles in the beautiful God. Bombay sun. He was like, oh man, I can't compare with this guy.
Jesus.
That's what happened.
When they found him, his towel was still on after he had died, like still around his waist.
Oh, so it didn't come off in the scuffle that apparently happened?
You think it would. They also said that because he had like obtained the revolver under false pretenses from the naval ship, it indicated that he had intentions of using it.
Right. I was going to say, I kind of caught something that I'm sure you're going to bring up.
Okay.
But if he intend, if because they're saying like, oh, well, he intended to kill himself. Why did he need 6 bullets?
Yeah.
To just kill himself?
Exactly.
Are you a terrible shot?
Exactly.
Girl?
Maybe.
Like, too you're nervous. Lying. The end.
Yeah. That, I mean, that's a really good point. I don't think they
Thanks,
brought that
I
up. But that is a really good
too.
Point. Testimony from Ahuja's servant indicated that there were 4 shots in quick succession in under a minute.
Oh, wow.
Which sort of ruled out this alleged scuffle that happened between the two of them.
Right.
Like you said, it's almost like he walked up and Ahuja came out of the shower and Nanavati just like
shot him.
Yeah. Prosecution also pointed to Nanavati just like, so after this happens, he just leaves the residence.
Bye.
Doesn't say anything to the servant that's
See
like,
ya.
Oh my God, there was this accident.
Right.
I accidentally
he
shot.
Just
no.
He's
he
like,
just,
are you going to clean that up? There's like blood everywhere.
He didn't say anything to anybody. He just left, went straight to the Navy ship and then
told his
from
officer.
There went to the police station. Yeah.
I do think it's kind of interesting that he like, okay, I know that he's a Navy guy and I know when you're in the military, you're really tight with your commanding officers and stuff, but it is kind of interesting that he went there instead of going to the police. And this is, I don't know, but it does kind of seem like it's like, help me.
Maybe. And
help
he was
me,
a commander. Like a commander is pretty
so it's
high
like,
up.
Hey, can we just, you know, boat away somewhere?
Yeah.
I need to go on a mission quick.
Yeah. And maybe the thinking was like, because I obtained this gun from the Navy ship, like it's going to be connected back to the ship.
Right.
Maybe that was part of it.
Oh, maybe.
It could just be. So they also, there's this discussion about whether or not he was in a daze after all of this happened, because some people were like, he showed up in a daze and just like didn't really know what was going on. And other people were
state.
Right. And other people were like, no, he like rolled up, gave his statement very coherently.
And he like went to the boat and wrote in the little book for Navy stuff.
So there is the potential of that, but it doesn't sound like that's the case.
I say no.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not sure why he went back to the Navy ship instead of just going straight to the
base, I think he was trying to get them to cover his ass.
I could see it. At the end of the day, after all of this, the Bombay High Court agreed with the prosecution. and found Nanavati guilty of culpable homicide amounting to murder, sentencing him to life in prison.
Okay, good.
And then this was upheld by the Supreme Court in November 1961.
Okay.
Okay. Now, remember, Nanavati was sort of like considered a member of the upper class,
right,
as this naval officer.
Fancy guy.
And public opinion for him had remained quite high the entire time. So, after 3 years in prison,
what?
Nanavati was granted a pardon.
What?
By then governor of Maharashtra. Okay.
Do your
please
best.
Forgive
you got
me.
It.
Vijayalakshmi Pandit.
Okay.
So he gets this pardon. He had to apply for it. I'll tell you, like, you have to apply for the pardon. But there was some discussion about, like, would this be seen as, like, being soft on crime or whatever? But they also were, like, public opinion was super high on this guy. So, like, I don't think there's going to be any backlash, and decided to grant him a pardon after 3 years.
From me.
Yeah. Well, he immediately left India and immigrated to Canada with his wife, Sylvia, and their three kids.
Oh, they're still okay. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No. They stay married.
Oh, okay.
Forever.
Oh.
Nanavati actually died in Canada in July 2003.
Oh,
and
wow.
The last I saw, it was like 2019. She had been moved to an assisted living facility.
Okay.
But as far as I can tell, they moved to Canada and remained married. And
okay. I will stay my indignation because, I mean, she was a woman. She couldn't even own property at that time. It's not like she could get a divorce
right,
or whatever.
Right.
So, okay. I'll give Sylvie the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah,
but, like, girl.
So that's the story of Nanavati, but you went so, like, back and forth on this one. No. So I'm curious, like, at the end, we've come to the end of my tale.
Uh-huh.
Where do you land on this? Are you?
I land so mad.
Okay.
I think that everybody who is accused of a crime that they did,
yes,
claims fugue state. They're like, I just didn't know, man. It's like, all right. And if he had come home and hot neighbor had been like porking his wife, then it's still not okay, but I understand, you know, shooting him then it's like, oh, okay. That's like split second decision, but you had the time to talk to your wife for a really long time. Be like, bye, toddle on down to your ship. Go and check out the gun. Go and check out six bullets, not one. Walk on over to his office. Oh, he's not there. I'll go to his home. Girl, you could have stopped. You could have gotten a bubble tea and just, like, calmed down. Like, you're in the Navy. You're rich. Just go get another wife. Why are you killing people? Stop it. Like, he could have stopped at any time. So I think that even though it was during the course of just, like, a couple of hours, it completely proves premeditation.
Yeah.
So it's like, you did it.
Yeah.
Like, the intricacies of Indian court are a little lost on me, as are every other court, because I'm a little dumb. But, like, he did it. He did premeditated murder.
So I find this one kind of interesting because it reminds me a lot of a case we've been talking about recently.
Ooh.
That of Gypsy Rose.
I was thinking about Gypsy Rose.
Because
she's pregnant.
Is pregnant, which I'm just like, oh, my God. Okay.
I hope
I got opinions.
Her.
We're not going to talk about that right now. But the thing with her is, like, because of her situation and because of her being in this home of abuse and, like, this history with her mom, public opinion for her was relatively high. Like, a lot of people sort of, I don't want to say necessarily supported the murder.
But
and even in this case, like, they didn't support him murdering this man.
But it's
man
kind of like, oh, that's kind of understandable.
Right, yeah. Right. Like, the public opinion was very sympathetic, I think, is a better word for it.
Yeah.
So now that she is out of prison, like, people are, like, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, like, sort of giving her girl boss status, like, you know, and same for him. Like, he got out and people were kind of like, cool. Like,
it makes me think of the movie Chicago.
Yeah,
where, like, there are all these murderers and they're, like, famous.
Yeah,
people are
yeah.
buying, like, their merchandise. It's like, oh, this is a little awkward. Like,
I kind of wish we would have talked. I would have done this case when we talked about Gypsy
girl,
a couple weeks ago.
I will
ago,
argue
but
with you about Gypsy Rose anytime.
I know, but it does. I mean, I think there are a lot of similarities with, like,
I was thinking of that too. Yeah. Like, when I was talking about, like, how the courts take that kind of thing into account,
mm-hmm.
of like the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the courts have very different rules from country to country, but that is interesting where it's like, was this understandable? Was this explainable?
Yeah.
But then the jury just has to go by the legal terms.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah, that's hard.
So
that's why I don't do jury duty.
I finally got a jury duty summons. And I've always wanted to do jury duty.
I'm sure
it's
you
not,
have.
It's not for the county I live in. It's for this county.
Oh, okay.
Not my current county. So I can't do it.
Aww.
You can't serve in another county.
Aww.
Yeah.
I was like,
what the hell?
That's lame.
You sent it to my new address. You knew when you sent this to me. Whatever.
You're such a nerd. You're like, jury duty.
I know. Everyone's like, I want to get out of jury duty. I'm like, please just put me in, coach.
Next time I get a summons, I'll be like, so I can't, but I have someone who
I know someone who would.
Let
me give you your information.
That's a good one. I've never heard of that case.
Thanks.
That's really interesting. Thanks. Yeah, I think he did that. That was premeditated. Girl, don't kill people.
Yeah.
And the 3 years, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Without knowing anything about Indian politics, that almost seems like a politician trying to be like, look at what this cool thing did. Don't pay attention to all this yucky political stuff I do.
Yeah. So that is.
That sucks.
That's the story.
So when you said crime of passion, mm-hmm. the first one, and that was interesting. I was like, when I was like trying to Google and come up with a case, I had to look up the definition of crime of passion, because the first thing I thought of was the imaginary scenario I thought of earlier with like the neighbor porking the wife and
right.
the husband
just
walks
like
in,
walking in,
kills everyone. So I was like,
sure.
No, I don't know if that's really the definition. And it just pretty much means a crime, usually not premeditated, that's at like the height of human emotion, mm-hmm. Which is a pretty wide net. And the first thing I think of when I think of crimes of passion is like that of like murder, suicide, kind of unorganized, not planned, fueled by strong emotions such as heartbreak or rage. And this case kind of fits the bill. But before its toxic climax is years of a truly toxic Hollywood relationship.
Okay.
This is the murder of Phil Hartman.
Oh, my gosh.
Are you familiar?
I am familiar. Uh-huh. We were talking earlier. We were debating about whether or not we've covered this on the show. And I'm like 98% sure we haven't.
It's the remix.
But I'm pretty sure that Janelle and I have sort of talked about this.
Uh-huh.
A very small amount
in a previous
episode, but I've definitely seen some things about it.
Uh-huh.
So, but I don't know the guts. I don't
know
the details.
And outs.
But I do know Phil Hartman. Like,
yeah,
he's kind of a big fucking deal.
Kind of a big deal. I didn't know. So I my parents are a little older, and they're both really into like I grew up watching Saturday Night Live and everything like that. But I had to explain to my husband this morning who Phil Hartman was. So let me go into
Rob.
I know. He doesn't know anything.
Divorce. Time for divorce.
Divorce, babe. Divorce. So Phil Hartman was a comedian. He was an actor. I was surprised. I always knew him from SNL and from like a couple movies, but he's in like a ton of stuff that I had no idea about. He had his fingers in a lot of pies.
Oh, yes, he did.
So let's get into Phil here. He was born in 1948 in Canada.
Oh, Canadians.
I know those Canadians.
Shake my fist at you.
Blame Canada. He was demonetized. He was the fourth of eight children.
Oh.
I know. He came from a very large...
What year was he born?
1948.
Okay. Okay, so that was still at a point in time where, like, having eight kids and eight or nine kids in the family was, like, pretty normal.
And especially Catholic.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
like
oh
they're
my
just going to be churning out
oh
the
my
kids.
God. I'm constantly surprised by how many kids, and then I have to remember what year it is. Like,
yes.
Oh, no, that was, like, normal.
My dad's dad had, like, 14 siblings. Like, that's crazy. That's too many
that
kids.
That is way too many kids.
I have two, and it's too many. They were a super Catholic, very religious, very conservative family. And Phil when he grew up, would go on to say that he didn't feel that he got the attention or the love, the emotional support that he needed from his family.
Yeah.
And he said part of going into comedy was finding that love from another source.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I think a lot of these famous comedians come from kind of very solemn backgrounds.
Yeah.
A lot of them do. Very sad.
Yeah. I think there, yeah, there's definitely a percentage of them.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. They got to kind of create their own joy.
Yeah.
So they lived in Canada.
But also, like, what's better to joke about than trauma? Like,
completely. It's the funniest part.
Yeah.
The funniest people are the saddest people for real.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking about Robin Williams now and I'm sad.
Oh, God damn it.
Let's cry. This is a crying podcast. Is that a thing? That's probably a thing.
What?
The crying podcast?
I don't know. I've never looked at it.
I could do that.
You
That's easy.
Could do that.
My moon's
you
in
definitely
water.
You could do that.
Now it's a Zodiac podcast.
Oh, God. No. Unless it's the Zodiac Killer, then yes.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Okay.
move on.
It's going to be some changes around here. So they lived in Canada, but then they moved to the United States when Phil was 10. For me, I think that must be one of the hardest, around the hardest ages to move,
mm-hmm.
is like in that sort of preteen era. Like you're just finding your niche, you're getting all your friends, and now you're moving not only to a new school, but a new country.
Mm-hmm.
So the formerly kind of quiet and reserved Phil began acting out a little bit, luckily
sure.
in mostly positive ways,
sure.
by becoming the class clown. So he was this really funny, kind of disruptive, a little bit of a stinker.
Yeah.
But discovered that he could receive that attention that he'd been lacking from his family from everybody else.
Sure.
And part of what he did was a lot of impressions.
Okay.
Loved doing impressions, which will come in handy later. He studied art after graduating high school at Santa Monica City College. And then being Phil Hartman, he decided to drop out to tour with a rock band, as you do. But because he had studied art and graphic design, as he was touring with this rock band, he started designing merch and logos. And he actually ended up designing things for bands like America, for Poco. And if you look up Crosby, Stills, and Nash,
okay.
their logo is that logo that he created.
Oh, nice.
So like the logo and all of the merch and all of the album stuff for Crosby, Stills, and Nash. So he was kind
really?
Of a big deal.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's how he was kind of like paying his way to like live through this tour band. It's like, y'all need me to draw something? I'll draw something.
Oh my God. okay.
So he was just being silly.
Yep.
But he ended up forming his own graphic design business to do these
all
things.
The best ones are graphic designers first.
That's right.
Just saying.
That's right. Not anyone we know, though.
No, not anyone we know.
Such a renaissance.
I don't know
woman.
Any graphic designers at all. Oh, my God.
So as he was doing this, which to me sounds like kind of a chaotic life, living with a rock band, drawing all these pictures, he still found time to get bored. And he decided to attend some comedy classes. And in the area where he was, there was a famous comedy troupe called the Groundlings, which should probably sound familiar.
Yes.
Lots and lots of modern comics can be traced back to the Groundlings.
Oh my God, tons.
They are amazing.
Yeah.
And they travel all through the country. Mm-hmm. They're really, really good. He spontaneously, like, he was still kind of a class clown, but I think he still was that sort of reserved kid inside. So he never really spoke out. But for some reason, one of the times he watched the Groundlings show, he decided spontaneously, because they encourage, you know, audience interaction, everything like that. It's mainly improv.
Yeah.
To get up and join the show.
Yeah.
One of the founding members of the Groundlings. I keep wanting to say the Gremlins.
The Gremlins.
So if I say the Gremlins later, I mean the Gremlins. Tracy Newman, who is one of the founding members of the Groundlings, said, "I never saw an audience member come up with that kind of excitement and energy. It was like a hurricane hit the stage, and I mean that in a good way."
Oh,
I'm glad
nice.
That they clarified.
Nice, yeah.
So they were all really impressed. He ended up joining their traveling troupe and traveling, doing shows, which is how he met Paul Rubens.
Okay.
And if Paul Rubens is a name that doesn't sound familiar, you'd probably know him by kind of his alias as P. Pee-wee Herman.
Yes.
And I didn't know this. I thought that that was Paul Reubens' thing entirely. Phil Hartman created the character of Pee-wee Herman.
Really?
Or Paul.
I didn't know that.
He created it. And he wrote, so Pee-wee Herman had a show at some point, and they had movies. He directed Pee-wee's Big Top Adventure.
Okay.
He played the role of Captain on the show and in the movies.
Okay.
And right before, so he was doing the Groundlings, he was doing his comedy, he was kind of still doing graphic design, but he was trying to decide whether or not to pursue acting.
Yeah.
Like, actually.
Yeah.
And was kind of thinking that he wouldn't. And then when Pee-wee's Big Adventure came out, it was such a success that it inspired him to keep going.
Wow. So I think that's really cool. That's really cool.
It was really sweet.
Love Pee-wee.
Yeah. Big and him Pee-wee and Paul fan. Reubens. Me too. I love Paul Reubens. And they were lifelong friends.
I had no
very,
idea.
Very sweet.
No idea.
Yeah. I never knew.
Wow.
Like, it's so funny because that's such a character that you can't see anyone but Paul.
No, performing. Definitely not.
So it's like
definitely
somebody
not.
Else came up with that. It's so weird.
Although, have you seen, you've probably seen the recent T-Pain single.
Where it's
The Pee-wee Herman. Like, I feel like if they did a modern day Pee-wee Herman,
it would have to be T-Pain.
T-Pain.
T-Pain and everything. T-Pain for president. I love T-Pain.
I love him. He's actually amazing. Good people. He's good people.
Sexy. As well. T-Pain, if you're listening.
Sorry, this is now the T-Pain cast.
T-Pain podcast. Yeah. It's a crying Zodiac T-Pain podcast. So he ended up getting pretty famous from Pee-wee and from his work with the Groundlings. He made a lot of connections during that. He actually did a lot of voice acting, which I didn't know.
Yes. I knew a lot of the voice acting.
Yeah,
stuff.
I was surprised.
That's more what I know him from.
And I didn't know. So he was in Dennis the Menace. Yep. He did a lot in Scooby-Doo. Mm-hmm. And then he was in a lot of movies. He was in The Three Amigos, of course. And my childhood favorite that I should not have been watching, Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Okay.
And it's an old Whoopi Goldberg. We should actually watch that.
Jumpin' Jack Flash.
So good.
I've never heard of that.
Whoopi Goldberg's like a little like 80s office worker.
What?
And she starts getting communication on her big old 80s box computer from a spy.
I have definitely never seen
it's
this.
It's so good. So she gets roped
Jumpin'
into
Jack Flash. What a name for a movie.
Because it's a song.
Oh.
Jumpin' Jack Flash is
Rolling Stones?
I think so.
I'm seeing a lot of pictures of the Rolling Stones.
Okay, I'm glad you said that because I almost said Aerosmith canceled. No.
Also, if you watch JoJo's Bizarre Adventure,
I don't.
There's a character called Jumpin' Jack Flash, but they do a lot of references to like classic rock. So,
oh, that's what I've heard, and that's what he starts sending her like song lyrics. So he's a spy and he's in trouble and he needs her help, but she's just an office worker. My favorite. This is maybe slightly politically incorrect, so Tiff, cut this out. There's a scene in the movie because this poor little lady just gets roped into this huge espionage adventure that she has no idea about.
Yeah.
And at one point, she's in, very vintage sentence, a phone booth trying to call someone to help this spy. And the bad guys are trying to get her, so they tow the phone booth while she's inside. So they're dragging her down the street, and she's on the phone with the police. She goes, they're like, where are you, ma'am? Are you in a vehicle? She goes, I'm a little black lady being dragged down the street in a phone booth. Please help me. It's such
God.
So she's got to do all of this crazy spy stuff, and she's like in her sensible heels. It's really cute. Definitely recommend it.
Yeah.
Whoopi Goldberg, if you're listening,
contact
please,
us.
Be my
please
wife.
Reach out.
I love you. So he was in that, and he was in The Three Amigos, and then that led to Saturday Night Live. Now a lot of comedians like dream for their whole lives of even just having a segment on Saturday Night Live. Phil wasn't that excited. He really kind of wanted to use it as exposure so that he could write movies for himself.
That
was his dream. Was he was so good at coming up with characters and committing. He really just wanted to be a film writer, like a script writer. But if you've ever seen like that era of Saturday Night Live, you really can't imagine it without him. He had so many like funny characters, and he could do anything.
Yeah.
I feel like in the beginning they put him as like the straight man a lot because he just kind of looks like a regular dad, but he is so funny and his impressions are crazy. My dad, I really like the unfrozen caveman lawyer. That's the best one. Please look up those sketches. It is so stupid. But I think a lot of people would know him as Bill Clinton.
Yes.
He impersonated Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan a lot. Super, super iconic. He was just so good at what he does. Lorne Michaels, the creator of Saturday Night Live, revealed that during his run on the show, Phil Hartman's nickname was Glue because he held the cast together.
Oh, wow.
Everybody else was so into like partying and all kind of like disorganized. And Phil would kind of be like, all right, let's just get all back together and stay on topic.
Yeah.
His co-star, Jan Hooks, a very talented comedian, she suffered with anxiety and actually some stage fright, which is so interesting that you could get to the level of Saturday Night Live and still have stage fright. Totally understandable.
Yeah, like, yeah.
And he helped her with that. She credited him with helping her stay on the show.
That's so nice.
He's just like an all-around really, really nice guy.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that he was without his demons. Man,
are you done? Did you do your... Is that the end of your career spiel for him? Or is there more? Because he also did like The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I have them like scattered around.
Okay, good. I was like, you're missing out on like...
I told Rob always says he's the biggest Simpsons fan. And I read, I have not seen The Simpsons. I've seen like bits and pieces of it. Yeah, I wasn't allowed to watch it. So I never watched it as a kid, but I have to now that I'm older. I know.
It'll make more sense now that you're older, too.
That's true. I'll probably think it's more funny. Yeah. I've like seen an episode here or there, but not like not more than a couple minutes.
Yeah.
But I read out all of the names of like the characters that he played. And Rob was like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, it said that they were pretty iconic.
Yeah, like Troy McClure.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm like, the actor who does the commercial. Like, I even know who that is. So I was like, girl.
Yeah, Rob, sorry. Not to jump ahead. I was like.
The Rob doesn't know anything about
it. Yeah. All right, continue.
No, but totally. He did a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So in when he wasn't on stage, Phil, I said this earlier, but I think he really never grew out of being that like quiet boy. He kind of stayed to himself. And as he got older, he was described more and more as sort of a recluse.
Okay.
Everyone in his co-stars would go out partying. He really just kind of wanted to be at home.
Yeah.
And he was...
I feel that.
Me too. I was going to say
I finally had to talk to my therapist, like, when is me... staying home, like how much time staying home is a problem?
Did she just diagnose you with Gemini? Is that what she did?
She pretty much was just like, I mean, if you feel like you need to leave, then leave. And if you want to stay home, then just stay home. And I'm like,
this just in, therapist confirms Irish goodbye is the right way to do things.
Mm-hmm. She's like, I mean, don't overdo it, obviously, but like, you know, like it's fine to stay home for. I was like, okay, cool. Thanks, Pam.
I'm just imagining you at a party in the middle of a conversation. You just pull up your phone. You're like, hey, girl. Yeah. Hey, Vicky's therapist.
Yeah.
I don't want to be here. Am I cool to leave? And she's like, are you at the party now? Like, Vicky.
Dude, I've been on the phone with my therapist when a mouse ran through my bedroom.
No.
Like, literally, it was like.
You're like, come kill it. Like
two years ago, it was literally like the first or second session with my new therapist, and I'm sitting in my bedroom on a video call with her, and I literally see the mouse run in front of the desk, underneath the desk that I'm sitting at.
The mouse wanted therapy too. He's like, actually,
crazy. She was like, oh my God, are you okay? Do you need to go to a different room? Like, I was like, yes, but I'm afraid to touch the floor. Yeah, anyway, sorry. Continue.
You run she's this great. I have to say, she's great. Podcast, but, and you're scared of mice.
I don't like rodents. They're gross.
That's understandable.
They're nasty.
I think they're cute.
They're gross. Vermin.
I love it. So Phil had this sort of like reclusive energy. His second wife, Lisa Jarvis, he would end up being married 3 times overall.
Okay.
But she said of Phil, my sense of Phil was that he was really 2 people. He was this actor and entertainer, and then there was the recluse.
Yeah.
Which I think is so interesting, because when you see him on stage, he's so present and so energetic, and then it's just like, nope, I just want to be by myself.
Yeah.
So that did not serve him well when it came to romantic relationships. So he was married, his first 2 marriages, he was married to his first wife from 1970 to 1972.
Okay.
Real short. And then the next one was just 82 to 85. So these were not long.
No.
These were not long marriages at all.
No.
Again, from his ex-wife, his second wife, and a couple personal friends, they said that his problem, besides really just wanting to be by himself, was that he was always after the new thing,
mm-hmm.
which I think is just like a male thing, to be honest. He just wanted the new thing. He was like, I've grown bored with this. I'm going to go do a new thing, which is not what you do when you're in marriage, says I.
Very true.
And then the newest, shiniest thing came on on a scene for his life, and that was aspiring model and actress Brynn Omdahl.
Okay.
She moved to L.A. to pursue acting and modeling, and she's very pretty. If you look up pictures of her, she
What's
is...
What's her name?
Brynn, B-R-Y-N-N.
Brynn?
O-M-D-A-H-L.
Omdahl.
She's pretty. She does, okay, I try not to be disrespectful, but she does have a mild case of crazy eyes, just a little.
Oh.
I saw a video recently, a TikTok, so you know it's real, that was claiming, like, when you can see the whites all around someone's pupil, it means they're crazy. And I looked at this picture of her this morning and was like,
I think she just has big eyes.
That's true.
Yeah, I think she just has big eyes.
Big crazy eyes.
Yeah, no, she's gorgeous.
But she's very, very pretty. And I will say, most of the people in their circles describe them as a very happy couple and that they seem to be stable.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why this was such a surprise. So Brynn, by all accounts and appearances, really, really wanted to be famous. She felt that she was born to be this actress. She really wanted to be in projects.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a lot of trouble, it seems, taking rejection, which I completely understand.
Right, right.
And that led to a pretty severe, series of pretty severe addiction problems, mainly to coke. But there was also some alcohol in there.
Yeah.
But she had been sober and in recovery when she met Phil.
Okay. I mean, that's good.
Right.
That's good.
Right. So it's like, okay, you know, that's part of your past, but you've got it under control now, so we're all good.
Right.
And they married not a full year after they met.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
A little quick.
I did the same.
But at the same time, I feel like relationships in Hollywood and entertainment move at a different speed than like normal people.
Completely.
Yeah.
Which I don't really know.
I shouldn't say normal. Then average, the average person. What is normal?
No, nobody with $1 million is normal. They had two children, Sean and Bergen. They were said to be lovely, devoted parents. And they really just seemed to have it all. And Phil would say that era, which was the 90s.
Yeah. The 90s.
I know. I remember it fondly. That was the happiest time that he had. They had this just nice time in the 90s. But as the months go on, this is a quote from one of his friends. As the months go on, the cracks began to show. And Phil does what he did with the last two relationships. He begins to withdraw emotionally. So his whole thing, this, and I hate this. This is now the relationship podcast, is she was very, it was kind of a fire and ice relationship.
Yeah,
he was very quiet. She was very bright and bubbly.
Yeah.
But very over emotional and reactive.
Okay.
She had, it seemed like on the outside, bright and bubbly and happy. On the inside, she had pretty severe emotional problems and trouble controlling her emotions. So when they fought, they would fight really big, but then instead of engaging with her, Phil would leave.
Yeah.
And he said he would tell friends that he would pretend to be asleep so that she would go away.
Yeah.
Now.
You basically just described every episode of 90 Day Fiancé to
for
me.
Real. For
That's real. That's literally like, yeah.
I just don't.
All these people. Yeah.
Don't do that. I hate that. I think that's so cowardly.
I
don't like that. I'm not defending her, but that's not a good thing to do when you're in a relationship. You have to deal with the problem. And all of the unresolved issues were really troubling for his wife, for Brynn.
Yeah.
And another troubling thing for her was her struggle with her career.
Mm-hmm.
It did seem like Phil kind of wanted her to focus more on the family. And she was like, I want to be famous.
Yeah.
So he got her a couple of like small roles in things. And then they just sort of wouldn't pan out. And she was trying to do her own thing. And this created a lot of resentment because as her career was floundering, non-existent,
He was
his
doing,
career
like, well.
Was better than ever,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He was just this legend. And instead of being happy for him, she was extremely jealous. And she wanted that. Which is funny because it also kind of seems with Phil, he was like, hey, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Such different personalities.
Oh, boy.
Most of their friends and people who knew them would describe them as a happy, stable couple, but they were both actors is something
right.
that I'll say.
Right.
And a lot of his close personal friends did not like her.
Well.
yeah, which, again, relationship podcast, if your friends don't like your partner,
it's probably a red flag.
Right. Right.
Just
right.
Saying. Just saying.
But yeah, his close personal friends, a lot of them did not like her and didn't approve of their relationship and said that she was very volatile and he had to physically restrain her in fights a lot because she would be going after him so hard.
Gotcha.
During this time, she did relapse with coke. She got a lot worse into drinking. She was kind of in and out of rehab, trying to get better. At some point, they did put her on antidepressants. So she was on Zoloft, which you can't drink and do coke on, turns
right.
out.
Well, turns out. Oh, my gosh.
I'm sure they...
Color me surprised.
Right. They probably mentioned it to her. Maybe she wasn't listening. But she, yeah, was worse than ever off the wagon. Worse than ever. In and out of rehab. Very, very volatile. And then we get to May 27th, 1998.
Okay.
So they've been married for a while. They've been living together. They have the children. But in the last few years, her addiction has gotten really bad and their fights have just ramped up and ramped up. So this is not a good period in their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
On May 27th, 1998, Brynn went out with friends. She went out to famous Italian restaurant Buca di Beppo, which okay. I wrote down because it is fun to say.
I've heard of that.
I have too. I was yeah. like, oh, Buca di Beppo. Like, yeah. I go there every Thursday. I'm like, oh, yeah, for sure. Buca di Beppo. I love saying it. It's like so cute.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, she's out to dinner. That's fine. Drinking. And
of course,
I got a little annoyed because a lot of the articles I read were like, her friends said that she was in a good mood, she was happy, but that she had had two drinks. And I'm like, when you have been to rehab, you cannot drink anymore. Like,
right.
I'm not trying to judge people who have addiction problems at all, but it's like, as her friends, you should have been like, hey, girl. You know,
yeah.
I'm not blaming them, but
no.
It's kind of like, it's not a nice casual thing to be like, oh, she's in recovery trying to live her best life and
right.
she's slamming cocktails. You know, it doesn't
right.
matter if it's two.
Right.
She can't control her drinking. She has a
yeah.
problem. So
yeah.
I thought that was a little crazy. Her friends were a little suspicious of me.
Good friends. Great friends.
Good. But we
best
love
friends.
Them. I
yeah.
love them. she went home and... It said that she had two drinks, but then it was said that the argument came because Phil was confronting her about her drinking.
Okay.
So it, you know, it does kind of seem like, I don't know if maybe she mentioned she had a few drinks or maybe she was stumbling in with her shoes off. Who knows?
Right.
Who really knows?
Right.
But he confronted her about her drinking and he was in particular very upset because they had had an issue recently where she had been drunk around their children and she
mm-hmm.
had hit her daughter.
Okay.
So he was like, you are not going to lay hands
right,
on my children.
Right.
And if you are going to be drunk around our children, I'm going to leave and you're never going to see the kids again. And then Phil did what he did in arguments and went upstairs and went to sleep.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Not a good plan.
No.
Now they, I couldn't find too much that went into this. I don't know exactly why, but the couple did have a couple of firearms in
sure.
their home. Nothing crazy.
As you
it was
do.
Just right, I
yeah.
guess. This isn't the political podcast, so
no.
I won't go into it. But
not
but
uncommon, we'll say.
Right.
Yeah.
They had a couple of like handguns. They,
yeah.
they didn't have like anything crazy.
Sure.
And at 3 a.m., Brynn entered the room with the sleeping Philip Hartman and a handgun in her hand. She, as he slept, she shot him 3 times, once in the chest, once in the throat, and once between the eyes.
Oh my gosh.
She was, I couldn't find a blood alcohol limit.
Yeah.
Well, we'll go into that in a minute.
Yeah.
But she was extremely intoxicated. She was way, way, way on coke.
Yeah.
So I don't know if she had like gone out and gotten it or she had like a stash, and she was on, I think, pretty high levels of Zoloft as well. She was very intoxicated.
What a combination. Holy moly.
Not a good cocktail. So she went to, she got in her car and drove to a friend's house.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, the children are asleep in the home. Like, where are you going, girl? Went to a friend's house. His name was Ron Howard. And I read...
Oh, Ron Howard. Right. Like Ron Howard?
I think so.
Like Ron Howard.
I think so.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Like the Ron Howard.
I think so.
Okay. All right.
Because they did do like a pretty lengthy interview with him.
With Ron Howard?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I didn't look at... I'll be real. I didn't look at the picture. Okay. Ron Howard. I didn't connect it until just now.
But yeah. I think you know who that is. Yes. Right. Okay.
Because they're in like a pretty famous like rich people.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm... I mean, they tend to live...
Right.
All in.
Right. And the way together. That like, they had taken his statement, it did kind of seem like they were paying a lot of attention to him. So that makes sense.
Okay. I also think that also makes me think of Arrested Development every single time. Did you ever watch Arrested Development?
I haven't, but I know like what it is.
Okay. There's a whole, I mean, it's done by Ron. It's done by Ron Howard and he does all the voiceovers, but he's also a pretty big plot point in the last like 2 or 3 Vicky, seasons of that show.
My brain was like Ron Jeremy.
No.
So I thought we were talking about Ron Jeremy.
No, Ron like, Howard.
Dick guy?
No. Ron Howard played like Opie in. Andy, the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah.
He's got red hair. He's done it. Basically directs a shit ton of movies now.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's him.
I don't know. This guy.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's probably him.
Ron Howard.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
I don't know.
That's hilarious.
This is the research.
I kind of love the idea of confusing Ron Howard and Ron Jeremy.
I don't know why. I don't know if it was just like kind of like the Hollywood Hills in my brain, but Ron Jeremy. Fine.
That would make sense, though. That would make sense that Ron Howard was a neighbor. I could see them hanging together.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And they did have lots and lots of famous friends. And he was someone who was a good friend of both of them and a good friend of her. But when she showed up at his doorstep at like 3:30 in the morning, like drunk and like I think she was in like some state of undress. Like I can't remember if it said that she was in her pajamas or if she was in like her underwear, but she was like clearly drunk, slurring, and it kind of made me sad.
Right.
When he opened the door, he was like, oh, man, like you again. So this must have been kind of a common occurrence was for her to show up places drunk and not be herself. So he said that he was like annoyed. He was
okay.
Like, what are He's you
like,
doing
oh, my
here?
God,
like,
why
girl,
are you here?
Like, let's party. Like, Bryn, go to sleep.
Okay.
And she was so known to be so out of it all the time that when she was like, I shot my husband, he was like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not. So he... drove her home. On the way to the house, she called another friend and confessed to the murder. The whole time she's saying, I shot him, he's dead. He's like, yeah. We're going to go to bed and I'm going to tuck you in. Like, shut up. It's fine.
Yeah.
And then when he went in and he saw, he physically saw the body, like walked into the room, was like, oh. Called the police. Now, this is just Rachel, the mom section. I'm like, where the hell are these children? They just left him in the bedroom. I'm like, nobody can... Like, so Ron Howard walked in, saw the body, called the police. I'm like, did you take the children out of the home? No.
I mean, if they were like, still sleeping,
I mean, if she's nuts enough to have killed it, man, I don't know. This is just because I'm a mom. I was like, nobody's gonna double check.
No, I getcha.
The police came. They immediately went to the children's room and... like escorted them
out.
Got
them out, yeah.
I don't think they told them exactly what happened, but the boy child, sorry, Sean, said that he had heard a door slamming several times. That's what he thought it was.
So
I thought that was kind of sad that they were slamming the door.
Yeah.
And as they were escorting the children out, one of them thought to look around and was like, where's Bryn? And then they heard a gunshot. She had taken advantage of the confusion, locked herself in a bathroom, and she had taken her own life.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, very, very sad.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, I was also kind of like, nobody
was
like,
watching her.
That would be first priority, drunk woman with a gun. Let's find where that's at.
Yeah.
But I guess they're not doing that. So yeah, unfortunately, she ended up taking her own life. Police stated that Hartman's death was caused by a domestic discord between the couple, which I think is putting it very, very lightly.
Yeah.
Very lightly.
Yeah.
Brynn's brother, Gregory Omdahl, did end up filing a wrongful death lawsuit against Pfizer because they manufacture Zoloft.
Interesting.
But it was very quickly.
That's pretty flimsy.
Right. Because they were like, hey, it definitely clearly states you cannot drink and do fucking coke when you're on Zoloft.
Right.
So it was just kind of swept under the table. I understand him being angry, feeling like someone to blame, but it's like, maybe go after someone who's not Pfizer. Let's calm down.
Right.
Hartman's friend and former SNL colleague, you'll know who this is as well, John Lovitz.
Okay. Yep.
This is kind of like reception to the crime, I should have said.
Sure.
Was the brother tried to sue Pfizer, and then John Lovitz, fellow SNL alum, he started a whole giant thing that Andy Dick, do you know who Andy Dick is?
Yes.
The comedian, that asshole.
Yeah.
That he got Brynn on coke. So he tried to like blame this whole thing on Andy Dick for getting the wife back on drugs. Now I wouldn't mention this normally because it's like whatever, but this is honestly like kind of funny.
Yeah.
So for quite a few years, John Lovitz had accused Andy Dick of this and was like, this is all his fault. Because he was friends with Hartman and Brynn, so I'm sure that he was feeling some type of
some resentment.
Right. But he said that after a while, he said, I no longer blame him. That wasn't something that I should have said. It is what it is. But in 2006, Lovitz said that Andy Dick approached him at a restaurant and said, I put the Phil Hartman hex on you. You're the next to die. Andy Dick said that to John Lovitz. And then John Lovitz had him kick the fuck out of the restaurant.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that the most Andy Dick thing you've ever
heard?
That
really is.
Like, what a freak.
And now I feel like that was definitely in an era, like, now Andy Dick
is like 2006.
Yeah. Now Andy Dick is, like, living his best life. I don't know if you've ever seen him on TikTok.
I have,
like, in the back outdoors.
I don't like that guy.
Hanging around.
Yeah.
But at the time, like, it was his whole thing was just being a fucking asshole and like doing
comic.
All of these 100% shock comic. So like,
which like there's a place for that, but do I have to like him?
No.
And I don't. The Brynn's sister and brother-in-law ended up raising the two Hartman children. They're now in like their 30s. They don't really go out in the limelight. They haven't really commented on it.
Yeah.
Which is good. So there was a lot of confusion by people in their circle, just sort of going back to their relationship because they did seem to be so stable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you looked closely, there were warning signs. I think her slipping back into her addiction was a big giant warning sign.
Yeah.
And there was something else that I thought was crazy and very interesting. When their first child was born, Phil's second wife, who was still friends with him,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were all still cool.
Right.
But she didn't know Brynn. But she saw the announcement, was like, oh, how nice, he had a child. Wonderful. I'm going to write a lovely little note and a card. She sent it, thought nothing of it. She got a letter back that was full of death threats from Brynn. Phil had never read it.
Yeah.
Brynn had, and it was a normal, I looked up the letter. It was so normal of just like, congratulations on your baby. That's so nice. She was like, if you ever talk to my family again, like, you will be very sorry. Like,
what?
I'm going to kill you. Very, very dramatic. So these emotional outbursts were not unheard of in those last few years. And I did look up Because I do know that you're not supposed to take Zoloft with cocaine and alcohol.
Right, right. I would say there's probably most things you shouldn't take with cocaine.
You know, just don't take cocaine.
Yeah.
This is the anti-cocaine solution.
That is the easiest solution. Yeah.
Put down the cocaine and listen to me.
Yeah.
No cocaine. But I looked up sort of what that does in combination, and emotional outbursts is one of the top.
Yeah.
One of the top things that happens. So
sure.
Don't do coke.
Good advice, generally. I agree.
Hartman is remembered through his tremendous legacy throughout the years, all of his work at SNL, all of his work through the Groundlings. Something that I just thought was kind of cool that I didn't know was we were talking about The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Same creator Matt Groening had cast him to be on another show that he was working on called Futurama.
Yep.
The role of Zap Brannigan was written for Phil Hartman.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is, he's one of my favorite. He's one of my favorite characters of all time.
Zap Brannigan is so funny.
And like when I heard that, I was like, oh, duh. He's totally Phil Hartman. Like Phil Hartman would have slayed that character. I thought it was really sweet. They wrote it for him.
Right.
And were like, hey, here's the part. But he insisted upon coming and auditioning anyway. And they said that he just slammed it. He was so good.
Yeah.
But that was not too long before
his
murder.
Right.
So unfortunately, he couldn't.
He also did some like Ren and Stimpy stuff, I think, too.
Yeah, he did a ton.
I don't know that he wrote for the show, but I think he did some voiceovers. Maybe he did write for the show.
I don't know if he.
I don't think he wrote, but he did some voiceovers for that.
Yeah, in 2007, Entertainment Weekly ranked Hartman the 87th greatest television host of all time.
Wow!
And Maxim has named him the top SNL performer of all time.
Yeah,
he's been inducted into the Canadian Hall of Fame pretty recently. That was a little underground Facebook group pushing it up.
Yeah.
So we will remember Phil Hartman fondly as this comedy legend who was taken too soon.
Yeah. Well, before you get too swept up into passion, don't get too swept up. But first, maybe check out this podcast.
My name is Hunter.
And I'm Haley. And we're your hosts of
Murder and Such, a podcast about true crime, serial killers, and other dark subject matter. Join us while we fill your ear holes with some crappy comedy and disgusting tales.
You can now find us on Spotify,
iTunes,
Stitcher,
Podbean,
and all of your podcatcher services. You can like us on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter
at Murder and Such.
Hope to hear from you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.
What? Were you not ready for the passion?
The passion. Or if you're going to be passionate about something, don't be passionate about coke and Zoloft and alcohol.
And murder.
Together. And murder.
And, well. I mean, anyway.
Why are we here?
Moving right along, yeah. That has been our episode this week. Thank you, Rachel, for coming back out again.
I'm honored. Anytime.
Yeah, it was a good, very good time, you know.
Yeah.
Doing the thing. We don't have anything really coming up just yet. Still pretty early in the year. So,
we're chilling.
When we do, we will definitely let you know. If you liked this episode, you can find more episodes like this at badtastepodcast.com.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zashevsky, the Enigma. You were a little early. This has been the Bad Taste Crab Podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks. Goodbye.
Bye.
It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town. We